Space Command's Move, and Artemis's AI Doctors. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Trump administration announced plans to move the U.S. Space Command from Colorado Springs, Colorado to Huntsville, Alabama. It's the latest twist in a back and forth that spans multiple presidential administrations. So why the move? And what's at stake with moving one of the country's combatant command units responsible for military operations in space? We'll speak with Colorado Public Radio's Caitlin Kim about the transition. Then, as astronauts venture farther away from Earth to places like the Moon and Mars, they'll need some help staying healthy. NASA and Google are partnering to test a new AI-driven medical assistant to help astronauts and their onboard flight surgeons. We'll speak with UCF's Dr. Emmanuel Urqueta about the role AI plays in providing astronaut health care and the challenges of keeping them safe in deep space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The U.S. Space Command is moving to Huntsville, Alabama. The unit is tasked with overseeing the U.S.'s military operations in outer space. It was restarted in 2019 by the first Trump administration, headquartered at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado Springs, and was fully operational there by the end of 2023. But Space Command's location has always been the subject of a political tug of war. Now, it's being moved to Huntsville, Alabama, a location the first Trump administration requested, but was overturned by the Biden administration. Here to bring us up to speed on the Space Command and this back-and-forth spat over its location that spans three presidential administrations is Caitlin Kim. She's Colorado Public Radio's public affairs reporter based out of Washington, D.C. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Hey, so Caitlin, you have been following the saga between Space Command and state of Colorado for a while now. Before we get into the latest drama, can you just give us some background? What is Space Command, and how does it fit into the broader scope of what the Space Force is doing?
Well, so Space Command is a combatant command, and I know a lot of people don't understand what combatant commands are, but basically it's the command that sort of coordinates all the military's sort of space satellite forces, whatever, all that, and coordinates it amongst the different branches of the military. So it sort of operates the space branches of, you know, whether it be the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, now Space Force, and all that. So it sort of like, it has, I think, the way I describe it, I think, is the big picture view of the U.S. operations in space.
And obviously, we don't know too much about it because, you know, there's a lot of confidential and classified information there. But do we know of what the workforce size is, some of the things that Space Command actually does? Paint us a picture of what the organization is.
So from what we've been able to gather, it's not a huge workforce size. It's a picture of the workforce size that they tell us, but we know it's over 1,300. So that's usually based out of Colorado Springs. And that's just the headquarters. Obviously, like everywhere else, there are different elements across Colorado, across the country as well. So it's not just Space Command. I mean, the fight is over Space Command headquarters, but like many other things, they have elements elsewhere.
Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced that the headquarters would be moving from Colorado to Huntsville, Alabama. Tell us a bit about the decision from the president and the rationale from this administration to move, you know, this large workforce from one part of the country to the other.
Well, I will start by saying I don't think this is a surprising decision to anybody who's been following this battle. Obviously, before he left office in his first term, President Trump then named Huntsville, Alabama as the preferred location for Space Command headquarters. During the Biden administration, part of those steps were like environmental reviews, and it was basically relooked at. And then Biden said, nope, we're going to keep Space Command. The final decision was we're going to keep Space Command in Colorado Springs. Now, when that decision was made, I will say there were concerns in Colorado that if Trump was reelected, he would want to once again revisit this. And that is what happened. So when Trump said that he, you know, last week, it was exactly last week or a little over last week, a week ago, he said that he was going to move it to Huntsville, Alabama. You know, he mentioned he made this decision last time and that the Biden administration just did it for political reasons. This is an accusation that has been lobbied between both, you know, Colorado to, you know, when Trump did it to Alabama and now Alabamans when Biden did it for Colorado. So this has been going back and forth. But, you know, he mentioned things like, you know, Marshall Space Flight Center being in Alabama. It's the home of the Space and Missile Command, Defense Command. So there are reasons Huntsville, it makes sense to keep it in Huntsville. cost of living. He also, which I thought was kind of interesting, mentioned how we get all these calls from Alabama lawmakers, you know, constantly pitching him on changing the basing decision to Huntsville, Alabama. I thought it was somewhat funny because I know this was one of the things that the Colorado lawmakers were doing to the Biden administration. So yeah, I mean, it was a big lobbying effort on behalf of the Alabama lawmakers as well.
Right, but before Trump left in his first term, he had wanted it to move to Huntsville. Then the Biden administration solidified Colorado, now back to Huntsville. So this is a very longstanding thing. You did some reporting earlier this year about these Alabama lawmakers calling on a investigation that would look into whether or not that was a sound decision. Did we learn anything from that report? Did that have anything to do with this decision, or is it completely political?
I mean, I'm not going to say it's completely political. I mean, I will say Trump did not mention this report at all in making the decisions. But the report sort of solidified both the Colorado lawmakers' arguments and the Alabama lawmakers' arguments. And again, this is just one of a number of reports that have been going back and forth between, you know, requested by Coloradans and requested by Alabamans since Trump first made this decision for the preferred location, you know, in his last week in office in 2021. I think what most people would agree on is that the basing decision, the process itself, was flawed. And like, this might be going too in the weeds for you and your listeners, but like, when Trump first floated the idea of creating and setting up Space Command, there was a process the Air Force used. It was like the normal strategic basing process. The Trump administration scrapped that after a year and said, no, we're going to change the process, right? First off, instead of having the Air Force decide on the short list of bases based on needs and capabilities, they had communities nominate themselves to be home of Space Command. And that short list of, I believe, six included, you know, Patrick in Florida, a base in New Mexico, a base in Nebraska, Texas, Redstone Arsenal, and Peterson in Colorado Springs. Redstone and Peterson were the only ones from the original process, the normal process. So you had a lot of reports, an IG report, an Inspector General report, as well as a GAO report that basically said, I think both in like 2022 and the one that came out earlier this year, that the process was not great in general, and it led to a lot of confusion. And the argument that the Alabama lawmakers made was it costs less to move Space Command to Huntsville, Alabama. The Colorado lawmakers were making the argument that the reports also backed up, which was Colorado is the best fit for operational readiness because it's already at full operational, you know, capability there, and that moving it could impact that.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Caitlin Kim. She's the public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio based in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Trump administration's decision to move Space Command from Colorado to Alabama. Maybe we have to take a quick step back here, Caitlin, and why is it that these states are sparring over Space Command? What does the location bring to that community?
Short answer is money.
Okay, yeah, it always is, right?
Like, you know, you're bringing new workers, you're bringing new industries, and then there's the secondary and third effects, right? Like, it'll help local businesses, like lunch shops, you know, hotels for when people come to visit, etc. There is a big economic factor in this. I think there is also sort of the prestige of hosting it. But I would argue, like, and this would probably benefit the Alabama argument, Colorado is already home to, like, Northern Command. So it already has a combatant command there. But you could also argue that Alabama, you know, home to Space and Missile Defense Command. So do they also need one? Maybe it should have gone somewhere else. Who knows? But it is, I think, primarily it's an economic driver.
In your reporting for CPR News, you know, you recapped what some of the Colorado lawmakers are saying about this, obviously criticizing the move, right? What have they been saying in light of this announcement earlier this month?
Well, so there was a bipartisan full Colorado delegation announcement, you know, both the senators and all eight Congress members that were saying, you know, Colorado Springs should be the home, you know, it's at full operational capability. It's a readiness issue. This is the wrong time to move it, because if you're going to move it now, you give you know, our adversaries, China and Russia, an advantage, et cetera. I will say there was a statement that came out from just the Republican Congress members earlier, or sort of late last week, that basically said, you know, the hit economically isn't going to be as bad as they thought, that a number of jobs will still stay at in Colorado Springs, that they're confident that the administration will bring, you know, Space Force or other forces or other missions to Colorado Springs. So it was more of a, you know, the economic effect is not going to be as bad as we initially feared. Again, I think for some of the other lawmakers, they still want to fight this decision. I just don't know how they do that. So that's something I'll be watching for. But yeah, that's their argument. It's a hit to readiness.
And do we have a sense of what this move will actually look like? Is there a timeline for this? Are all of the hundreds, if not thousands, of staff from Colorado Springs moving to Huntsville? What do we know, if anything?
So we don't know a lot, to be perfectly honest. And this was a question I asked last week, and no one could tell me anything. Like, originally, this move, when they were still talking about it in 2019, was going to take several years. I think, and this is what the Republicans said, it will take several years for it to move. Now, I spoke with Dale Strong, who is an Alabama congressman. He thinks it takes about 14 to 18 months to build the headquarters in Alabama. He said that President Trump doesn't want to do like more than one movement. So you have to wait for it to be built and then they'll do the transition. I think one of the things that, you know, we have to wait and see is how they're going to do this transition, the timeline, the time frame that they're thinking of. A lot of it will depend on how quickly things can get built. And then I think how many people do want to do the move? I think that is also a big question. I can't remember. I think it was in this report that you mentioned in earlier this year that one of the concerns Space Command leaders had was that a lot of people wouldn't be willing to do the move from Colorado to Alabama, and that that was going to also impact readiness, that they would lose knowledgeable staff. Whether or not that actually happens, I think, again, remains to be seen.
And finally, Caitlin, do you get the sense from speaking with Colorado lawmakers that, you know, more of this could come if this truly is political? This could be seen as retaliatory. Are they concerned that other assets may move from states?
I don't think they're concerned that other assets will move from Colorado. I think Colorado has a very strong aerospace infrastructure, and it's hard to move a combatant command that's already established. We'll see with Space Command, but because technically it is established, but I think we'll see how that goes. But no, I do think at least the Democrats are saying this publicly, that they do think it is political. And part of the reason they're saying that is because when President Trump talked about moving the command to Colorado, or one of the reasons why he wanted to move it away from Colorado, he didn't mention anything military readiness or related to the military at all. He talked about Colorado's mail-in voting system, which has nothing to do with military defense or otherwise. So I think for them, that was a big issue. For them, they think it's political, but I don't think they're thinking there'll be more retaliation, to be perfectly honest. And I think that would be hard to do.
Caitlin Kim is the public affairs reporter for Colorado Public Radio, based out of Washington, D.C. You can check out her reporting at cpr.org. We will also link to it on our website. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, how NASA is turning to AI to keep its deep space astronauts safe.
There's going to be parts of the mission where Mars and the Earth are going to be on opposite sides of the sun, and there's going to be absolutely no communications for, you know, weeks at a time. So that is where AI comes into play, really, to develop a fully autonomous medical capability for Mars missions and beyond.
The challenges of keeping astronauts healthy as they venture to the moon and Mars. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's space-based telescopes are spotting some incredible astronomical observations, like a glimpse at the birth of a star and a galaxy over 51 billion light-years away. We'll catch up on the latest observations from JWST and Hubble. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking astronaut health. As astronauts venture farther away from Earth, providing healthcare so far away from home becomes a challenge. To help with that, NASA is partnering with Google to create an AI medical assistant that could help the onboard medical officer diagnose any issues mid-flight. The Crew Medical Officer Digital Assistant is being developed for future testing in flight. Here to talk more about the challenges of deep space medicine and how AI might help keep astronauts healthy is Dr. Emmanuel Aketa. He's the Vice Chair of Aerospace Medicine at the University of Central Florida's College of Medicine. Dr. Aketa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you for a really interesting topic. NASA and Google are working jointly on creating an AI assistant to help physicians on space flights, especially when contacting Earth is not an option. Before we get into this, let's set the stage. How does current medical care work during space travel, like, for instance, astronauts on the International Space Station?
Yeah, with the space station, we have been there for more than 20 years. We haven't had any major medical incidents, specifically nothing that has required to deorbit, you know, the spacecraft and bring astronauts back. Number one, because there is a very stringent medical requirements for the astronauts, but also number two, because we have pretty much real-time 24/7, almost no delay communications with mission control in Houston, Texas. So for any medical condition that could happen in space, the astronauts, regardless where they are orbiting the Earth, they can just grab a phone and call mission control. And there's going to be a flight surgeon, a physician there that is going to be ready to answer any questions or you know, guide them on a specific medical procedure. And, you know, worst case scenario, and again, this hasn't happened, but if it's needed, we could evacuate someone in a matter of hours, bring someone back from space. And I think, you know, as we keep venturing deeper into space, the next step, of course, is going back to the moon. We're going to have a few seconds of time delay communication, so you could still practice pretty much telemedicine like we do on low Earth orbit and the space station. And, you know, most of us during COVID, I'm sure that we had some type of medical encounters through telemedicine. And again, on the moon is going to be just a few seconds. And again, most medical, you know, requirements could be guided in that condition. Now, the challenge there is that we don't have evacuation in a matter of hours, right? Now we're talking about days. So that medical complexity keeps increasing and being more challenging. But the last frontier is, as we really go deep into space, particularly to Mars, where time delay communications is going to be about 40 minutes, right? 20 minutes each way. There's going to be parts of the mission where Mars and the Earth are going to be on opposite sides of the sun, and there's going to be absolutely no communications for, you know, weeks at a time. So that is where AI comes into play, really, to develop a fully autonomous medical capability for Mars missions and beyond.
You mentioned that with these moon missions, these Artemis missions, there really isn't that delay. We're looking at using AI assistance when we go deeper into space like Mars. But the case has always been made when people talk about moon to Mars that we practice everything closer to home so that when we venture out into deep space, we've worked out all the kinks. When it comes to this AI assistant, is that essentially what is happening with this Artemis test?
Yeah, absolutely. And to, exactly to your point, I think the paradigm is that we will go to the moon on the way to Mars, right? So that we can develop and keep evolving all of these technologies that we'll need to safely say that we can send someone to Mars and bring them back. But also the space station works as a test bed for the moon, right? And this is how you keep scaling complexity, you keep developing procedures for longer time delays where you can safely test them when you have all of those capabilities now on low Earth orbit and the International Space Station. So absolutely, we use the test beds that we currently have to develop and to safely test these very unique medical requirements with the platforms that we currently have.
Dr. Aketa, walk me through when an astronaut might use this. When are they going to say, hey, Google, I need help? In what situations would they lean on this AI assistant?
Yeah, I think, you know, the list could be infinite, right? So NASA is most likely going to send 4 astronauts on a mission to Mars. One of these is likely going to be a physician, But what are the odds that the physician is the first person that will get sick, right? And then one of the other three will need to take care of the physician with, you know, limited medical training. And even say that if the physician doesn't get sick during the mission, that person is not going to be able, you know, to be an expert in all specialties of medicine, right? Which you would need to have cardiologist, you need to have an endocrinologist, all of the specialties. So even in that case, the physician is not a fail-proof method, right? So what I think is going to happen on those missions is that once symptoms start, you would be able to ask what technical name of this project that NASA is working with Google AI is. A CMODA is a crew medical officer digital assistant. So think of this as a virtual physician that is, you know, inside a computer, like the way that, you know, you can ask your Siri or your Alexa or your preferred AI tool in your house. You would do it the same way, right? You would ask this person, okay, well, these are my symptoms. Ideally, the system would know exactly who you are, would have some of your medical data before you went into space. And then it would start running through all of these large language models to come up with the best assessment for diagnostics and treatment. And then in this paradigm, you would only inform mission control in Houston or you know, wherever it is in the future, what has been done. And they would just, you know, give you a thumbs up of, you know, the treatment. The goal is that we will develop what is called IMO or Earth Independent Medical Operations. And this is, I think, one of the very nice and clear examples of a pathway to develop those capabilities.
It's a pathway. What else needs to happen to get that medical independence for these astronauts? You mentioned to Mars, we're talking months at a time that they are away from Earth traveling in deep space. What else is needed to keep these folks safe when it comes to their health?
Yeah. So one is, of course, being able to diagnose, right? To safely diagnose and to be precise of what is a diagnosis. And then having the diagnosis is only the first step, but then how are you going to treat, right? And if you think of all of the possible medical conditions that could happen to space, just to give you an idea, NASA, over the last several years, they developed a list called the IMM, is an integrated medical model. And there's a list of 100 plus medical conditions that could theoretically happen on a mission to Mars. And that list is incredibly broad. It goes from nail delamination all the way to, you know, losing half of your blood or having heart attack or, you know, stroke. So theoretically, you would need to be able to, again, number one, diagnose the condition without a physician on board or without, you know, specialties on board. Number two is with the limitations that you have to do, you know, additional examinations in space. Like here and on Earth, like you could go to the hospital and they could do, you know, a CT scan and an MRI, blood work, whatever you need. In space flight, you're going to be pretty much limited to ultrasound and perhaps, you know, a few blood tests that you would be able to do in space. So you're getting also limited information that you can get to come up with a diagnosis. And once you get the diagnosis, you have to treat it, right? And this spacecraft is going to be pretty small. You're going to have four people traveling for 900 days. That spacecraft will need to have all the food, all the water they're going to take for 900 days, potentially all of the medications that you will need to treat 100 plus medical conditions for four people, and, you know, enough consumables to treat. It's also a huge logistical issue on what should you bring to that mission, right? There's a huge discussion on how would you treat, for example, a surgical disease, like, for example, appendicitis or cholecystitis, your gallbladder or your appendix getting inflamed and infected. Traditionally, you go to surgery and remove them, but we're not going to have a full surgical suite on the way to Mars. So you would likely treat those ones, you know, with antibiotics and perhaps, you know, percutaneous drainage of the abscess. So really, the entire spectrum of how you diagnose and treat and then follow up and make sure this person gets back to a healthy state so that he or she can get back to their assignment on the mission. It's a huge, huge challenge for these type of missions.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Dr. Emmanuel Urquieta. He's the Vice Chair of Aerospace Medicine at the University of Central Florida. We're talking about medical care in space and how a new AI model could help change that. Dr. Urquieta, as a medical professional yourself, when you think about humans being sent on deep space missions, what is the kind of worst case scenario? What would keep you up at night if you were a flight surgeon on a mission to Mars?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to me, one of the biggest challenges is having the supplies and having the pharmaceuticals that you need to treat a medical condition, whichever is the medical condition. The challenge that we have is that any medication that you take, you know, even if you go to your favorite pharmacy and buy it, they have a shelf life, right? They're usually about 1 year or so. And after that, they expire. And either they don't work anymore, right? For whatever is their purpose, or they can get toxic. And then, you know, you get even more sick or you get something even worse than what you have that made you take that medication. In spaceflight, all of these medications need to be repackage, right? You cannot take all of the bottles because they use a lot of volume in space. So you need to take them out of the original packaging, put them on, you know, other bags that are going to optimize the volume. And then that starts actually decreasing the shelf life of medications. So a lot of people are looking at how can we produce pharmaceuticals in real time in spaceflight so that you would have pretty much an infinite pharmacy for whichever medical condition you need. And there's people looking at synthetic biology. How can you modify some plants so that they can actually produce some of these pharmaceuticals? So that is something that has my mind thinking all the time on these challenges that need to be solved so that you can, you know, safely treat a medical condition.
Fascinating. Finally, I want to bring the conversation back to AI. You know, this initial model that was tested by Google, it shows promise with accuracy, you know, ranging from something like 74% to 88% in diagnosing these common medical issues. I'm wondering if, you know, much like a lot of the technology that has been used in space, especially the Apollo program and space shuttle, there's spinoff tech. Could what engineers and scientists and medical experts learn from this particular AI model be used closer to home for diagnosis of people here on Earth?
I think, you know, everything that we develop for spaceflight and particularly in the medical domain has direct applications to terrestrial healthcare. Spaceflight is a forcing function that makes you think different and helps you to accelerate development of technologies. And, you know, when you're in space, you're isolated, you're far away from medical care. And really the paradigm that needs to be developed is that you cannot go to the healthcare professional, but you need the healthcare go to you, right? And that's what needs to be developed for spaceflight. So terrestrial populations that are fully isolated, and, you know, traditionally we think of places in Africa or, you know, Southeast Asia or, you know, South America. But even here in the US, we have a lot of populations that have to travel, you know, several miles to see a primary care physician, or if they need to get specialized medication, they need to travel, you know, several miles as well. So once we develop these capabilities, we will also increase access to healthcare to populations that otherwise would have to, again, travel you know, a significant amount of time to see a physician, and furthermore, elderly populations, right? That it's actually a risk taking them out of their house to see the physician. Again, the paradigm that you can bring the healthcare to the person is, I think, going to be very, very applicable to a myriad of scenarios terrestrially that will improve healthcare for all of us.
Dr. Ikeda, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. Our handles on Instagram and Facebook are @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might be a good guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance for LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.